The point here is to tell you where we are standing concerning the Planck satellite project. And in a nutshell, this is a third generation CMB satellite, and we are trying to map the microwave background and isotropies. Now, to give you a visual idea of what we're trying to do, let me just contrast, you know, the current status of affair, which is essentially what WMAP measures and what Planck is hoping to measure. And that's pretty simple. I mean, here is a status. We're trying to exhaust the information there is in the temperature and isotropies and do pretty well on polarization and isotropies. So that's the visual part of it. Now I'll try to put a bit more substance on this. So the Planck concept, as it was initially spelled out, was to perform the ultimate measurement of the CMB temperature and isotropies. And this has immediately a number of implications, which is you need to have a full sky coverage, so all the modes are being measured. Go and measure all the primary anisotropies, which is essentially well into the damping tail, and typically this means about 5 arc minute resolution. And then you need to have a sensitivity, which is not only good enough to measure all the modes with signal-to-noise ratio greater than 1, but you also need to make sure that you are making useful measurements in the sense that you are able to control all systematics and in particular foregrounds. In other words, you need a wide spread of frequencies and high sensitivity at all these frequencies in order to be making sure that you're be mapping CMB and isotropy. And then the design goal was much more open concerning polarization, because in those days, I mean, this was like 96, the selection, polarization was not yet as prominent. Anyway, we're trying to do our best to go after that. So this was selected at the same time than WMAP, I mean, within days, okay, in 96, and we had the hard time to explain why WMAP being selected yesterday, why ESA should select Planck anyway, and I think we've made a convincing case. So this became the third mission of the Horizon 2000 program of ESA. It turns out that the concept that we propose is essentially to do a very small number of detectors per frequency, but that all of these detectors would be really close to the photon noise of the CMB itself, at least for the CMB channel. And that's sort of the overall view of it. Now, so the sensitivity goals is essentially to cover a very large frequency range, essentially 30 in frequency. And this entails essentially immediately to use two type of technologies. The one that is was on COBE and was used also on WMAP, which is HEMT, and this gives rise to the low frequency instrument, although now it's been cooled to 4K, and these are the sort of design goals for the LFI. And these are just visually, this is a picture of the focal plane. So what you see is that 2 horns at 30 gigahertz, 3 horns at 44 gigahertz, and then a row of horns at 70 gigahertz. And all the rest there is HFI. So HFI now is using bolometers called 2.1K. This is a technology that was never flown in space yet, but has been proven on suborbital experiment, and in particular Boomerang, that brought us, you know, the flat universe essentially, has been using this, as well as Archaeop, as well as Agbar. I mean, quite a number of the experiments you've heard about are actually using bolometers. So here is the overall design. And there has been much studies to show the robustness of that concept to against foregrounds, vicious foregrounds, maybe, in terms of component separation. So to put these goals in perspective, I've contracted here, I mean, expressed a sensitivity rather in micro K per degree, that is how much fluctuations of detector noise there is in a 1 degree patch. And here are the numbers typically in the CMB channel. So you see this is essentially 1 micro K in a degree, in a 1 degree patch. This is to be compared with the current WMAP, and this is like, for 1 year, this is like 15 micro K per patch. In other words, you know, you need a factor of more than 500 in exposure time to make up for that. So this is essentially the overall goal. And as you see, we have quite a number of channels at that sensitivity. The observational site is essentially to go to the Lagrange point number 2 of the Earth solar system, which is the sun will be 150 million kilometers there, and that's another 1.5 million kilometers just there, and happily rotating at about 1 RPM and doing big scans of the sky and measure, to do the measurements. I'll come back to this. Anyway, so the point is that the satellite will always be facing, well, presenting its back, rather, to all the major enemies, let's put it that way, thermal enemies, being the sun, the earth, the moon, and so on, all within a tiny angle in the back. So overall, this is a cryogenic experiment, which means that everything is essentially coupled with everything. And this means that this is a little bit of a, you cannot just say, well, I build a satellite. I mean, the industrial contractor will build a satellite and provide the hotel room for the instrumentalist, and here where you sit. Well, actually, this is nearly the opposite. You essentially build the whole thing from the inside out. You know that you are trying to cool bolometers at 0.1K and to preserve them, and then you have to build the whole thing, and well, here is the current design. And this, whoops, sorry, I'm not the first one to watch this happens. So here is the overall satellite, and within there is the LFI structure, which is this thing, which is using HAMS. And within the LFI, in the same focal plane, here is the HFI, and the HFI itself is a Russian doll. And in the end, it's converged to sort of something that is about that size, 10 centimeters, where bolometers happily sit at 0.1K. Okay? Now, so this means that there is a pretty complicated cooling chain, and which whose goal is to bring the LFI HAMS to 18K, I'm sorry, and the HFI bolometers to 0.1K. And so, in essence, there is sort of a first stage, which is radiative cooling, which brings the overall thing to about 40K just by radiating out in space. Then another stage, which is an 80K cooler, which is provided by the US by sorption pumps, and I will show you a couple of picture of hardware. Then this goes to a 4K stage from the UK, and then a 1.6 and 0.1K stage coming from France is a dilution cooler, which works in the absence of gravity. So here it is. Here is the first part of the cooling chain, which is a satellite as it was not so long ago. So all the hot stuff is there within at 300K. Well, this is a solar panel, so the sun would be in the direction of the ground. Then you have all these V-grooves, which are meant to totally isolate thermally from all this hot stuff, so that the top bucket there would be at 40K and radiate with this big radiator, if you wish, to outer space. So no, and it's been designed in such a way that no light from the sun can ever actually penetrate in the bucket. Even, or it would have to go through multiple reflections through here, through here, through here, and that. So it amounts to controlling beams pretty well. So of course, what this means is that if you are trying to thermally insulate all the hot stuff from this cold stuff, it means that all the plumery, for instance, has to go through all these complicated loops and so on to go up there. So that's the first stage. Second stage is this cooling, the sorption cooler, which is redundant, and it allows to cool the LFI instrument to 20K and provide pre-cooling for the HFI to about 18K. Next step is this 4K, which are back-to-back compressors. And then the final thing is and that was what allowed this very concept, is that the last stage is a dilution fridge, in essence, but it uses capillarity of these two fluids going into very thin pipes rather than gravity, which is the usual thing to actually mix on the ground helium-3 and helium-4. And here is this basket weaving concept, which is within HFI, within the HFI box at the end. Here it is. I mean, this is a support structure, and there are the piping system there. And that's what cools the bolometers to 100 millik. Now, inside HFI, here is essentially what I just showed. Here is the basket weaving where there is the cooling. And what you see is essentially a Russian doll things where you have an external structure, which is essentially mostly at 4K, which holds the horns. Then there is an inner enclosure, which is at 1.6K, which holds filters. And there is another enclosure. And finally, it gets to the 0.1K. And so here is the actually realized box. Now, in addition to just making it plainly work together, going from one state to the other, there's a major issue there. A bolometer, which is a measurement piece, is essentially a calorimeter. So if you have huge fluctuations from other stages, well, essentially you're done. So the big question is thermal stability. And that's what I tried to capture, is to accomplish the planned goal, there were quite a number of breakthroughs that needed to be accomplished. And, well, of course, first and foremost is the sensitive and fast bolometers is one thing. But then a lot about the overall rest of it, which is all the thermal stability and the lack of coupling between all of these stages. So there were a lot of worries. And in addition, of course, I mean, making sure that you have clean beams and so on. Well, I won't get into the detail. Now, the next, of course, what has been the big thing is to, well, is this actually working? So I'm just showing a couple of pictures there of, for instance, HFI as being in the lab, being integrated into a test case, and here it is, and then in something that represents the spatial and microwave environment, and then where we could happily go in after the measurements. And the good news there is essentially the design goals, I mean, even though they are pretty ambitious, have been met. And which is the subtitle there, is that it would take about 500 years of WMAP survey time to reach 1 year of HFI. So yes, we are coming afterwards, but I think it's we hope to bring some new pieces of information, as I will show. So this is the same thing for LFI. I mean, this is with its large support structure, the part of the focal plane, and for the time being, looking at the cold load here. And to put a long story short, essentially, all the results are essentially according to requirements. Now, the next step has been to, in November 2006, has been to bring together HFI and LFI because they are really tightly integrated. This is the band. And after that, things have been proceeding pretty quickly to integrate with the satellite. Here it looks on December 9, right, ready for vibration testing. Then this thing has been moved around many times. So here is in an Antonov going from Nice, I mean, Cannes actually, to ESTEC. Then in April, which is, I mean, was not so long ago, it's been load balanced to make sure that this thing, when it's rotating, is well, it's just like for the tie. I mean, you know, when you are changing a tie on your car, you just do the same. Then it was ready to be shipped in April 18th, going to the Liège Center, and here it is. So this was as it was on the 19th of May. So here is Planck. Here is this big tank. And this is the first and last full thermal vacuum test that will happen. In other words, this will make it to the space environment in terms of temperature and pressure, which means that we can turn on the instruments and that they can operate in normal conditions. So we have done all the cabling and so on last week, and in the coming weeks, the test will be ongoing. And we cross the fingers that because this is the first and last, and then it goes essentially to launch pad, bearing some really big prime with that. So next, well, launch is currently slated for December of this year to go on an Ariane 5 from Kourou in the French Guiana. It's a joint launch with Herschel on top and Planck on the bottom. Of course, this is uninsured, and this all goes off on this big thing. We travel to the L2 point in about 2 months, and reach 100 millicare about 50 days after launch. Then calibration and performance verification for about 2 months again. And then service starts. And nominally, we should have 14 months of operation, which allows us to cover 2 full sky and have some minimal amount of redundancy. And we do hope that helium permitting, and everything looks good so far, that we will be able to extend these by at least another survey, maybe 2 more, that is 2 complement of 4, which would be more comfortable to fight systematics. Then, essentially, after, you know, getting in Cannes 1 year of data, we have essentially 1 year of data analysis and 1 year of science processing. So the idea is in 2012, there is a first public data release by ESA with all accompanying paper, about typically 50, 10% of which being the core cosmological papers. And so what we do is what we plan, and we promise that, is to give it all. That is the clean, calibrated timelines, in addition to the maps, the full sky maps, per detector, per channel, as well as CMB maps, as well as a power spectra and likelihood codes to fit your own model at which. Earlier than that, we will be producing as soon as we can on the first year of data, on the basis of the first full sky, an early release compact source catalog, which is a US responsibility. And the point there is to go for reliability, not completeness, And the point is, we hope that this will allow an Herschel follow-up on the most interesting objects. So, and Herschel being cryogenic, I mean, it was the point of making this as fast as possible so that this could be done. Now, helium permitting, we are hoping to actually do, you know, another double the size of the data and have a second pass on the analysis. Now, internally, what we are trying to achieve is essentially every 6 months go for a new iteration of the data product to make them mature and then get feedback from people in the collaboration about all the possible screw-ups that there might be there. Now, just a quick view after those, what happens? Well, essentially, we go to the L2 point, and you see the trajectory there, and then there it gets injected into a halo orbit around the L2 points, which is shown here. Here is the L2 orbit. And as you, well, we're just going around, I mean, happily. And in 6 months, I mean, let me just show the next step. So at L2, where we keep rotating, essentially, and you see the path. Essentially, I mean, this is a primary, so you can sort of see that it's capturing a ring of data. Well, it will show, and sort of scanning the sky in the process. Of course, it might not be exactly as simple as this of just getting real time, but that you do capture the ID. So after 6 months, there will be 6 months of data taking like this. You will have covered because you are doing a circle and essentially rotating like this. So you will have covered essentially the full sky, so that will be survey one. It's still fun, so I'll let it go till the end. So I didn't do this one. This was a great animation by one of the ESA guys. And here it is. It's simple, right? But we will have to remove the emission of all this galaxy, right? I mean, before, and so that's we will still have a little bit of work to do. Now, let me just keep going. Of course, there are sort of subtleties where we actually spend most of our time on. We are actually not doing exactly remaining anti-solar. We have some modulation over these to create some kind of new ways of redundancy and so on. So there are all kinds of detail there. One thing that I didn't say, it's about 1 RPM rotation, right? So this is a sort of a slow thing. And we keep doing this for about an hour, well, 45 minutes, which means that you have a built-in redundancy. You go through the same circle in the sky about, say, well, 50 to 60 times, right? And then you have essentially your final sensitivity on that patch. Data processing, well, what it is? Well, essentially, the idea is that we start from physics, and this is responsible for the CMB sky. And the CMB sky is just one component that is added to all kinds of other things, which some of them are related to physics, by the way, directly in the same manner, and then some are maybe one day related to physics, but are very far from this, like our own galactic emission. So that creates the emission of the sky at a particular frequency. And essentially, the instrument is there. It converts this to a time-ordered information, or at least, well, or more precisely, a series of timelines. Now, the data processing is actually inverting that process, going this time-ordered information, somehow get back to frequency maps, then using all of these 9 different frequencies, combine them or malax them in such a way you extract the primary component, this is there, and from there make the contact with physics by looking at the statistical properties and the error distribution. So to do that, you really need to write and verify a model because what you get to start the process is now the TOI, right, plus all ancillary information. So you have this time-ordered information, and the idea is to relate this to physics, make a model of it, invert it, and that make sure that you assess errors in the process as accurately as you can and convincingly. So to do that, you essentially, I didn't write down the equations, but there are pieces where you can actually get terms of the equations from ground measurements, like what is the frequency response of this thing? Well, you go in the ground and you measure it because there is no way you can do it in space. There are other parts of that where you're bound to do it in situ. Like, for instance, you will map Jupiter, what is out there, and this is, you know, Jupiter at the frequency of the resolution of Planck is essentially a point source. So what you see is a point spread function. So you go in gory detail, you model it, and so on, all the way to levels which are models all the way to 90 dB. And then that, hopefully, you have another term on the equations. And then you go through all of them. And then you use that model to infer the sky. And then you know that you have different detectors, so they should all infer the same sky. Okay. Or sometimes the detector comes back to the same location of the sky. So first you go for the inner consistency, and then you go between the consistency between detectors, and then you are progressively building up and verifying that your model, your effective model of the measurement is correct. And then you rapidly go all the way to physics, hopefully. And in the process, you use templates, like for instance, you use thermometers on board to make sure that the thermal variations are being monitored. You might also use foreground tracers from other, you know, H-alpha, whatever, to cross-check that, you know, you're getting what you expect. The key here is redundancy. Anyway, so that was essentially data processing in a snapshot. Just write down an equation and invert it. And in the process, make sure you've written down the right equation, at least the right effective equation, that one that describes the process, and make sure you carry the errors in the process. So the data reduction is essentially in a nutshell there. I mean, you have like, you know, 10,000 numbers every second that comes in, and then you go through it, which is about 2 terabytes, which is by today's standards not that large. That's fine. And then you go through all the way to a number of maps, then you go there to a number of extracted CMB maps and power spectra, and then maybe in the end 20 cosmological parameters. So there are a lot of preparation ongoing, and I will skip this because I've seen what the chairman is telling me. Now let me, so in a nutshell, this will be one of the basic products that we will be going after, which is essentially 9 frequency maps plus 14 equivalent maps of the polarization components. Okay? Now, it will allow covering a pretty broad science, and then from primary anisotropies, which I believe is what most of you are concerned here, but there are also secondary source of anisotropies like integrated Sachs-Wolfe, gravitational lensing, reionization, and so on. But just, I mean, covering, you know, these will be the first sky maps in a number of the frequencies, so there will be a lot of rich astrophysics that will come out of it, and that we'll not try to detail. Now, you can get, what is in the following is essentially can be found in the blue book, so-called, that we put out as a revised science case in 2005, and this is on the web. So let me just walk through a couple of examples. And, well, here is just, to make it concrete, we've been trying to show what it is to compare WMAP and what Planck on similar models so that this could be put on equal footing. So here is, for instance, NS of 0.95. This is the model. And it's actually been drawn from an NS equal 1, I believe. So here is WMAP. Here is Planck. And Planck has maybe 25 times the sensitivity of WMAP and 3 times the angular resolution. So in essence, out of the number of modes out there that can be measured, well, WMAP is extracting about 10% of those. So, well, we're trying to get those. And what you see is things which are really borderline to extract, you know, these are the kind of differences from deviation from a standard model that you are trying to go at. Well, you see that 0.95 is a bit marginal with WMAP. And as you know, you've been presented the evidence. Well, here is how it will look. The deviation from the NS of 1, well, here is the kind of deviation you would get. So this should be unmistakable. Well, you know, you can do the same thing for polarization. And essentially, Planck will do, in a nutshell, Planck should do as well, essentially, for polarization that WMAP on temperature. So this is sort of, so it's not final, but this will, you know, go one big step further. Accuracy forecast, well, this is a game that one can play. You can sort of say, well, let's assume that the trend continues on the, you know, the same 7 parameter model. Then, well, here is WMAP errors and or contours, and here are the Planck ones, and you see this pretty large reduction in every dimension of this eight-dimensional space. And for instance, things like NS, well, these are, you can see the sort of the marginals. Well, you will reduce this uncertainty to about this. Of course, nothing says that this will remain true. I mean, that this model, it's just an example. Now, of course, this relies on assumptions that this is still a very minimal model. There is no guarantee that this remains true at the same level. So, of course, one possibilities, for instance, either curvature modes. Well, let me just go flag this. I mean, another deviation which has been measured is the imprint of B modes. Well, here, I mean, you know, it's going to be very, very challenging. And what we hope is that, you know, with Planck, we should be able to detect, not indirectly constrained, but actually detect point one. Of course, we'll do, you know, all of the standard constraints that we can do with the CMB data, neutrino mass, effective number of species, the W, and so on. Now, the point is Planck is a much lesser reliance on external data sets, which have often very complicated astrophysics that come in. And so we hope to, in any case, provide the foundation for future dedicated projects, like, for instance, on W. Now, one of the very interesting topics is departures from isotropic Gaussian. And because all of this is essentially that everything can be captured in 2 points. Well, of course, I mean, we will see a non-Gaussian sky because the sky is non-Gaussian anyway, and there are all kinds of residuals and so on. But we will try to look for, of course, the signatures of small deviations from that. And, well, non-trivial topologies is an obvious one, primordial magnetic field, topological defects like cosmic strings. And let me just take one example of the kind of things that will Lansing and a couple of slides. So here is the signature of Lansing on the unlensed CMB sky when you put a 10 to the 15 solar mass cluster on the line of sight. Okay, and well, you can sort of see, I mean, this is a kind of tiny deviations that we're fishing for. That allows to reconstruct the matter power spectrum projected along the line of sight. I won't say much more on that. Now, FNL. FNL is just, let me just, essentially the idea is that you can characterize the initial field as being a linear part plus some small coupling in a generic fashion, and this is a way of constraining this. So this can be used by essentially, constrained essentially by using the bispectrum. So I will flash you what are the kind of things that we're going after. Here is FNL of 100 versus 0. The huge difference that we're going after, right? So here is, okay. Now, let me, so far, we have only upper limits. We have a tentative 2.5 sigma indication that there might be something there. I'm sure that you've heard about it. Now, I think what is interesting, I'll just want to show that, is in 8 years, WMAP will bring us to a sensitivity to FNL, which is about 20. Okay. Planck will be at the order of 3. So it means that if there is a detection by WMAP, this will be 7 times more sigmas, if you wish, in terms of reliability, or the ability of finding some tiny deviations. So far, we have a model which is very, very, very simple, and most of the components have been actually, well, maybe not guessed, but assumed by people like Jim a long, long time ago. I mean, essentially, you know, flat, Gaussian, adiabatic, power law, and even scaling, I mean, and even scaling variant. Now, there is still no sign of deviation from that. Okay? All fits there. Now, there are many indications that we might be on the brink of changes because there are, as you know, there are most of the theoretical attempts that we're making do bring some deviations from that, like NS, you know, different from one by, say, 0.03 or something. So this is essentially where Planck is about. I mean, we're getting to the point where we hope to sort of see these deviations. And there are quite a number in store, and I'm sure you'll be inventing some new ones. Now, concerning the conclusions, CMB is still unique in its class in bringing together so many of the fundamental components of cosmology. That is, together the laws themselves, because, I mean, you need a framework, and the parameters. And so we just, and as I try to highlight, is we are far from having exhausted the information content of it. Maybe we maybe mine 10% of the temperature, and I don't know, I didn't do the calculation, but maybe 1% of the polarization. So we have a lot out there. Now, the first survey data is less than a year away from here, from now, and plus about 3 grueling years of data massaging. And, well, this is your opportunity to make predictions rather than post-dictions on a number of these things. So far, so good, that is, Planck is in line with the rather ambitious design goals that we set out in 96, which at the time looked on the verge of impossible. But, of course, nothing is like the real sky. Now, I think as far as field, we are moving away from actually, you know, checking that the broad picture is fine, and that's what we've accomplished, which is not a little, to actually look. Whoops, sorry. To actually look at all the deviations that nature may have provided us with and will be revealing in terms of physics. Of course, that doesn't mean that Planck is the end of it. I want to remind you this. I mean, there will be remaining degeneracies. We will need some other experiments. That's pretty obvious. And I also want to point out that I just focus on some narrow aspect of the science case, which I thought was the most interesting for you guys. On the other end, I mean, we will be providing, you know, unmatched maps of the sky. And we think that it might be at IRAS, that is, people will be writing papers at a big rate every year, just, you know, mining that database. And I will skip the other thing, which is we are making also progress on specific, you know, there are all kinds of specific projects that we're trying to focus on. Okay?
Right, thank you. Questions, Jim?
Very, very poor. And I think that the, for that, let me just, if one might be faster than trying to go through, you know, by this thing. If I just want to remind you of one slide I showed. Of course, it depends on where they are found. I mean, the closer to the detection limit, the less you can say, right? That's nearly obvious, but here, okay, so what you're asking is how well can we get at NT, the slope, right? And assume that this is about 0.1, which is up there, okay? So you see that this is the Lansing contribution, essentially. So this is what you're fighting against, right? This is Lansing that is the B-mode generated by the Lansing from large-scale structure of the E-mode. So the primordial contribution might be just appearing above the Lansing contribution for R of 0.1 there. So you see that we do have to be in pretty big boxes, okay, to be able to make actual detection and not only upper limits. So extracting an NT out of this, that meaning a slope of that part, well, sure, we will be doing this, but that's not going to be very precise. That's, so I don't have the number can probably be found in the science case. I don't have it on the top of my head. But clearly, finding NT and then looking at consistency, like, you know, the famous consistency relationship and so on for inflation and so on. I think this will have to wait for the fourth generation satellite.
We have time for perhaps for one other short question, if there is one. Yeah.
You just flashed it, but how well will you be able to do on bounding alpha isokurvature?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, what I showed was a rather a more complex model where there would be all of the modes allowed. And even in that context, all, you know, not only what has been done so far is a really encapsulating this in just a one and essentially a second power spectrum. You can do much better than that. And I can refer to you as an example to the Moodley, Bucher, and so on paper that actually do some forecast on that. The point there is you can make those assumptions and you are still able to broadening the parameter space and still, you know, use the signal to noise ratio that you have to make still inferences between different, still have not ridiculously large error bars. Okay. Okay.
Let's thank Francois again. And our next speaker.